Hello, welcome along to Writer's Routine. This week, we're chatting to Anthony McGowan, and he's another author who just has stories in his bones. He's published over 50 of them. He's written for kids, for young adults, for adults. He's written philosophy books, sports books. His new one is Lark. It's the fourth in the Truth of Things collection, meant to be a trilogy, then he wrote another one, now it's a collection. It's just been nominated for the 2020 Carnegie Award. We talk about why he wrote it, to tell the story of his hometown, also how he decides what genre of book he'll write next when he's so prolific, and how he knows when his story is on the right track.
You know that you're doing something right if the characters perhaps don't want to exactly follow that plot. They have their own ideas, and they might wrench you either side of your plot line. But I've never really struggled with working out what to do next once I've had that original idea. It's simply a matter, you know, my job as a writer is to sit down and work it through to the end. And it's, you know, the difficult part is just those, that mechanics of getting myself physically, getting my fingers moving. Once I'm there, it's just not trudging along, but you follow that path.
It's all on the way with Anthony McGowan this week on Writer's Routine.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Yes, welcome along. My name's Dan Simpson. This is Writer's Routine. Thank you so much for listening. It's the podcast where we take a look inside an author's working day to see how they work, how they plan, how they plot, fingers crossed, how they hopefully publish as well. This week, we've got Anthony McGowan on the show. He's written all sorts. Deadly Beast, interactive novels for kids, thrillers for adults. His new one is aimed at reluctant teenage readers, and it harks back to the type of forgotten town that he grew up in. He chats about the two places that he writes in our interview, and when he thinks it's best to go to the British Library instead of just staying at home working in the study all day. And also you can find out why his desk is just so messy as well. Sounds like it's covered in broken iPads. We talk about why he writes in so many random genres, and how he decides what he will write next, which, to tell you the truth, isn't always what he wants to write next. And he'll explain more about the famous pat the dog trick. Also, listen to the immense quality on this recording, by the way. We were miles away from each other when we spoke. But apart from me being maybe a tad quiet, I don't think you'd ever know that we weren't in the same room. I think it's a nice rambly chat this week, so stay there. We start, as always, with what Anthony McGowan sees around him in the place where he sits down to write.
Oh, blimey, it's a terrible mess. Well, I've basically got two places that I write, either in my study where I am now or at the British Library. But here I'm surveying a horribly filthy and cluttered desk. There's used dental floss lying around. There's two broken iPads. There are two cameras, one of which is broken. There are old train tickets. There's my cricket cap. There are two dirty coffee mugs. Pens strewn around, USB drives strewn around. It's genuinely awful. Oh, in the corner, there's a Madagascan musical instrument called I think it's called a vahila, which my son brought me back from Madagascar a couple of years ago. So that's my desk. Oh, and two broken phones as well.
Begs the question. I do want to look around your room further, but begs the question. Why don't you just slightly clean it up? What is it about the clutter that's is it not getting in the way? Is it maybe helping the chaos of your story? But what's happening there?
I wish there were good creative reasons for it. I think what happens is that every 6 months or so, my wife forces me to tidy out my foul study, and for about a week it's tidy. Then gradually the filth and the clutter reaccumulate, and I just kind of literally I brush it all aside so I can work. I think I've got a very high tolerance for mess. So, most of the time I just don't see it. As long as I can reach my keyboard, I'm fine. But so there's no positive reasons for it, but nor are there strong reasons for me to tidy the thing up until finally it becomes unbearable. And I'm kind of I think it was about 2 weeks ago that I last had a bit of a tidy. So maybe it's almost time for it again.
So that's the despair of your room. Tell me about the joy of it then. Is there a window with a view? Have you got books on a shelf? Have you got art? Is there any inspiration there?
Yeah, well, right in front of me, actually, on the wall, there's a big montage that my wife did for my 50th birthday, which is lots of photographs in a frame of the kids mainly and her and a few of me. So that's a nice thing to look at. On my right-hand side, I've got a rather messy pin board, which is my sort of to-do area. So bills to pay... I'm looking at now, blimey, the stuff I'm supposed to be doing, it's terrifying. So that's in theory helps me stay organised. My pin board on the right. To my left, see, right in front of me, there's just a blank wall apart from this large montage. To my left, there are two windows. So I've got to kind of strain round to look out the window, which in theory helps me prevent distractions because I'm the kind of person who would just gawp out of a window all day if it was there. And then behind me, there are my bookshelves. Which is mainly my kind of working or useful books I need ready access to, so dictionaries and other kind of reference works, and also behind me there are two guitars. This is all in quite a small room. There, it's the smallest and most unpleasant room in our entire flat.
Is there any story inspiration there, Anthony? If I were to walk into your study, cluttered as it is, if I could find it, would I have any clue of the story that you're telling at that point? Are there post-it notes? Is there a whiteboard? Is there any clues there?
No. I mean, but if you look at my shelves behind me kind of change depending on my project. So my last big adult book was a book, a kind of history of philosophy. So I had shelves full of philosophy books. So you might work it out from there. But I think it's more if you came in here, you'd view it as inspiration for your own book. If you're writing about some eccentric hoarder or mad person, this would be his room. I mean, in terms of my organisation for writing, I tend to do that all electronically. So, most of my notes are in digital form on my computer rather than being analogue notes on bits of paper.
You also mentioned the British Library there.
Yes, yes.
Talk to me about the decision of when you're going to write there, when you will write at home.
Again, it's kind of done on whim and various other factors. I mean, it's definitely the place where I work best, and I try and get there as often as I can. And, I mean, often it's maybe 2 or 3 days a week when I'm right in the middle of a project. Because it is the perfect... I don't know, do you know the British Library at all?
Very well, yeah. I'm not a fan of the way it looks. I don't really like that Baroque style, but being in...
Okay.
Not Baroque, what am I wittering on about? Brutalism. I don't like that brutalism.
Yeah.
But being inside, it's a spectacular place. If you can get a seat, what's the secret to it?
That's true. Get there early enough, because most of the people there are, I suppose, they're students and scholars, and they're so bone idle that it's only from about 10:30 that it starts to fill up. If you get there for 9, there's always a seat. And I usually work in the biggest reading room is Humanities 2, which you probably know. But there's also Humanities 1. There's also Humanities 2 upstairs where there's occasionally seats. And if things get really bad, I can work in the rare books reading room where there's always a few seats. And even that, then in the further flung parts of the library, there's social science areas and science areas full of science nerds. And occasionally I'll sneak in there.
You said that is the place that you definitely work best. Mm-hmm. Why is that? What is it about the British Library that's bringing the words out of you?
Well, it's partly just I've made that commitment to get there. I mean, that's an element of it. And once I've made that commitment and gone there, I feel I can't just sit here and do nothing. I've got to work. But also the atmosphere, I think, is perfect. It's quiet without being silent. So it's not kind of eerily silent. And so you can concentrate on your work. But also every now and then, you can't work solidly for 6 or 8 hours. You've got to have little mental breaks, and you can just sit back in your chair and gaze around this rather beautiful room full of interesting, strange, eccentric people. So for me, it's that perfect combination of being quiet enough to concentrate when you need to do that, but also having some visual interest around when you just want to let your mind float for a while.
Now, the main part of the show is talking about the actual writer's routine, and you're, you know, over 40 books down now, as you mm-hmm. say. It makes me think, and what you've already said about you knowing that you work best in the not eerie silence, but the quiet mm-hmm. of the British Library, that your writing routine might be quite studied. You know exactly what you need to do to get the words down. So, Anthony, talk me through yours. The moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed on a day when you are sat down to write, how does it look?
Are we assuming that we're in the non-lockdown mode?
Non-lockdown, yeah. You can go out as much as you'd like.
Yeah, well, My wife works. I have two children. One's off at university. My daughter's in the sixth form. So the first part of the day is me basically shambling around in my pyjamas, making breakfast and tea and getting everyone else sorted so they can leave the house. And then if I'm working at the British Library, I'll make myself a packed lunch, which is a almost infantilizing thing that I do. And I'll cycle off to the British Library by about 9:30 usually, trying to get there before 10. It's about a 25-30 minute cycle into the British Library. And that actually, I find cycling a particularly creative mode of transport, because my body knows what it's doing, so I don't have to think consciously at all about the process of cycling. So my mind already is beginning to think about the job in hand, you know, whatever book I'm writing. I've always found that I've had a lot of my best ideas when I'm cycling. There's just something about being in motion, but without having to particularly think about it, that just, I don't know, the creative juices get going. So then I'll reach the British Library, find my desk, get my bits and pieces all sorted out, my laptop plugged in. And then usually I'll spend probably an hour actually faffing. So doing nothing useful at all, whether it's, you know, checking email or mucking about on Facebook or Twitter, any kind of work avoidance strategies that I can come up with. And after about an hour, I'll suddenly realise, okay, I've got to knuckle down now. And I tend to, when I'm actually in the process of thinking and writing, it's all quite fast. So the ideas come quite quickly. I hammer away with two fingers. Can you touch type?
I am lucky enough, yeah, because I kind of grew up with a computer, so I'm of that age where we can all kind of do it blindfolded.
Yeah. You know, every year, I think this is year I'm going to learn how to touch type, because it would be a massive advantage just in terms of wear and tear on my two index fingers, which take a real battering. But anyway, I hammer away, and I'm also quite aware of the fact that I'm quite noisy when I'm doing this. And I remember a couple of years ago, I was hammering away in the library, and this very nice American elderly lady smiled at me after a while, and she said, I can tell when you're really being creative because of the noise. I think it was a rather polite way of telling me to shut up.
Shut up.
So it tends to come in very dramatic spurts. So I might then do a 40-minute or an hour spurt of intense writing, and then I'll have often another hour when I'm just basically doing nothing again. And that sort of takes me around to lunchtime. I wander off into the courtyard of the British Library, eat my packed lunch, whatever the weather. I sit in there in the rain or the shine, and then back in for a sort of similar session in the afternoon. So that's my British Library work day, which is essentially kind of periods of indolence interspersed with periods of intense, dramatic typing. And my work day at home is a bit more sort of leisurely of pondering and milling around the flat and doing vague bits of housework while I'm sort of considering and thinking. And then I'll get in front of my computer and again have that intense, rather violent typing spurt. Well, when I started, you know, the first I reckon the first 10 years, I was much more methodical about that. I used to make sure I wrote 1,000 words every day. And I wouldn't stop until I'd done my 1,000 words. And, as you know, you can write 1,000 words in an hour. And sometimes I might do that. And then I'd try and carry on. And on a really good day, I might write, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 words. But I would never stop until I'd written 1,000 words. Now I'm less rigorous in that sense. I still hope I've done 1,000 words a day, but it's more I've stopped counting the words now.
Why do you think that is it because, as you say, over 40 books down, maybe you just have confidence that you will get it down some way?
I think it's almost sadder than that. I think I've just got less productive and less sure that I can write 1,000 words of good prose every day. I found historically was that there was no real link in between quantity and quantity. So if I wrote really good 3,000 or 4,000 word day, those words would be just as good as a painful 500 or 1,000 word day. So it was just once I got going, then it was all of roughly the same kind of quality. But I had a kind of confidence that it was whatever I wrote would be all right. And now I don't know. I've used up so many words. I mean, I don't know how many words there are in 50 odd books, but I'd guess over a million. And now it just genuinely feels that there are fewer inside me, and I've got to work harder to wring them out. So I think now, rather than 1,000 word plus, I would guess that I'm more of a 500 words a day person.
Well, that leads to this question. How perfect do those 500 words need to be? Or are you quite a vomit drafter and you tend to just clean it all up in the edit?
a weird hybrid of the two. As I kind of said earlier on, that the words come out quite fast when I'm in the flow. But they tend to come out more or less in the finished form. I think it's because you get some animals that have a long gestation period where they, you know, the kind of the baby's growing for a long time inside the mother's womb, like elephants. Then the birth is sort of dramatic and rapid. And I think it's a bit like that. So somehow a lot of the editing, if you like, is going on before I even write. It's kind of forming itself in my head almost subconsciously. And so certainly when I look, my first draft is very, very close to my final draft. There's very little tinkering that goes on. And even in terms of getting the edit back from the editors, that tends not to be very much changed.
Well, this is an interesting one. If you say that now you seem to almost be less productive than you were at the start, mm-hmm. during your days of bursts of creativity, where you are having an hour or so at a time, just pondering, waiting for the mm-hmm. to be rather old-fashioned and romantic about it, waiting for the muse to strike. But I know, right? I know that's the type of podcast we are. But have you learned any trick to help it on its way? Is there something that you can do that does help that creative burst happen?
Well, there's definitely these two almost physical concepts of momentum and inertia. So that there's the inertia you have to overcome just to get going. I love the idea of the muse coming and visiting you, but I think with me it's more of an initial wall I've got to get over to make myself start writing. And often, I mean, literally physical things will help, like a cup of, a second or a third cup of tea. And you get that little kind of caffeine buzz, and that is it just enough of an energy shove to get you going. If I'm still writing towards the end of a day, and I'm a bit stuck, then yes, a glass of wine or beer might help. I shouldn't. That's probably not good advice. I've often got a final decent 500 words at the end of the day by having a glass of wine and just I don't know, helping get the fibres loosened up.
Is there any?
Genuinely, that big problem is inertia of getting going in the first place, and just something as you know, a strong coffee or tea can often just be that make that difference. I think that once you've got that momentum going, it's important to carry on going for as long as you possibly can, because once you stop, there'll be that another episode of inertia and having to overcome that wall again.
How much structure is there to the end of your day? When you come home from the library, is that it? Or do you always find the story... Are you able to put the story to bed? Or is it always there somehow and it's just a case of... of waiting to go again with it?
Well, you know, there's so much sort of family life happens in the evenings. It's very hard for me to then to come back into my study and do more work. So pretty much when I get home, that's it. But I'm presuming that subconsciously that there's still some work happening. You know, there's things are being reassembled or there's ideas forming. You know, while I'm making the family dinner or just watching telly in the evening. But I suppose, again, I would say probably the most important creative part of my life as a writer is my life as a reader. And it's the evening on the whole where I do my reading. So, you know, so many of my ideas spin off from other texts or whatever that I'm consuming in the evenings.
Let's talk about the plotting and planning. How do you know what you are going to write every day?
Well, I suppose... might make sense to take a step back from that. So how I first think about the overall story, because that tends to come as a sort of sudden flash of an idea or a concept. So my very first book that I wrote, actually my second one that was published, was a book called Hellbent, which is about a teenage boy who dies and goes to hell. And the idea for that just suddenly came in a flash of that, you know, both that initial concept of the boy dying and it being a comedy and a rough idea of what the plot would be, almost didn't have a temporal space in which the idea occurred. It was literally came to me the cliche of the flash, but it was just there. So then it was a matter of simply sitting down and writing out, expanding on that original idea. Again, I certainly originally and to a large extent now, I was the kind of writer that would sit down and work through from chapter one through to the end, roughly knowing where I was going to go. And so I might be pulled in different directions along that path. But broadly speaking, I would write chronologically. So then each day's work was simply picking up from where the narrative ended yesterday and trying to take it on as far as I possibly could. You always have to be wary about trying to look inwards and examine yourself, because it's very hard to get yourself right in a way, and it's your own mythologizing can obscure things. But I suppose it's two factors. One is that I would never describe myself as being particularly bright, but my head is full of stuff. There's a lot of material in my head. So I've got a very large hard drive and a rather slow processor might be the way to think about it. I spent a long time at university, I did three different degrees in the end. So there's a huge mass of information in my head. And so my philosophy book was just a way of kind of eventually getting that out of my head. But I suppose also maybe the way to explain the variety of work that I've done is just the fact that life is complicated and you never quite know where you're going to go in it. It's not, you know, your life hasn't got a plot other than the decisions that you make. And so when I first started to write, I always thought that I would be an adult writer and that I would write maybe one literary novel a decade, and I assumed that I would have a job as a teacher of philosophy in a provincial university, but I never got the job, because I did a PhD in philosophy, but I never got the job teaching in university. I had a really boring job as a civil servant, but both boring and rather hard, and I began to think of a story, and that's when I came up with the idea of Hellbent. And when I began writing it, I had no idea that it would be a book for teenagers or young adults or children. It was meant to be an adult book. But it kind of gushed out of me. I thought it was a work of staggering genius, the way you do. I sent it off to various agents. They all rejected it, saying it was totally insane, would never get published. But eventually I met an agent who said, why don't you try writing something more sensible, a bit more commercial. So then I wrote an adult thriller called Stag Hunt, which the agent took it on, managed to sell it.
Can I quickly cut in there? This has led me to a separate question. When you've met the agent and he says, how about you write a commercial adult thriller? The idea for Stag Hunt, how forced, using the word forced in quotation marks, I don't mean it to be aggressive or insulting.
No, not at all.
How forced is that idea? You sat there thinking, I need to write an adult thriller, what's it going to be?
Yeah, you know, that was exactly what happened. So my agent, she's actually a woman, Stephanie Cabot, William Morris, she tried to sell Hellbent. So, and again, she got the same kind of response. It was just too different, too weird, too eccentric. And it was at that point she said, look, I think you're a really good writer, which always helps. Can you think of something more commercial? So I went off and came up with two or three ideas, which I sent her. One of them was Stag Hunt, which is it's a book about a stag weekend in which there are a group of quite posh kids, young men rather, one outsider, a working class person gets invited to it almost by mistake, and it turns out there's a serial killer working on the stag weekend, bumping people off. So that kind of idea, I worked out the idea, went to her with it on a two sides of A4. She said, this is perfect, write this. I wrote the first few chapters, and she managed actually to sell the first few chapters to a publisher just based on the synopsis on those chapters. So I'd then gone from being someone who was writing a kind of slightly eccentric book about a teenager who dies and goes to hell to writing an adult thriller. But once the adult thriller got published, then suddenly I wasn't this kind of crazy outsider. And so then publishers started to look at Hellbent. And it was only at that stage that I thought, well, this is probably not really an adult book, Hellbent. It's a book for teenagers. So I slightly rewrote it. It was picked up by Random House. So I suddenly had these kind of two different strands, my adult thriller writing career and now a teenage writing career. I mean, I can talk about why the adult thriller writing career kind of tragically went wrong. But the teenage career just went a bit more successfully. So that pulled me in that direction. This is a really complicated way of answering why I've written such a bizarre variety of books. Teenage books, particularly the kind that I write, which aren't sort of fantasy based, that they don't ever sell that many copies. You know, most of my teenage books sell 10,000 copies. No one gets rich on that. So my publisher asked me to write for younger children, which just simply sell more copies. So that then pulled me back more youthfully still. So by this stage, I suddenly find myself writing for teenagers, for adults, and for younger children without ever really planning any of it. These are just things that happened. And it turned out that I was, I could just about do all these things with a modicum of success.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now, before we get back into it with Anthony McGowan, I've had an idea, which might work, it might not work. But, it's week 12 of lockdown and I'm doing very little else, so I thought I'd give this a go. How do you fancy getting your book to kind of sponsor the show for an episode? You see, I've just put a tier up over on our Patreon page, patreon.com/writersroutine. And if you sign up to that for just 1 month, I promise, you can stop the pledge right after that. Your book can sponsor the show. So if you've published one over the last few weeks, if you've worked so hard on getting your first novel down, and lockdown it has kind of hasn't really helped what you've worked for ages on, if it hasn't helped it get noticed, I will do that for you, right? I will give it a big old plug at the start of an episode. Do you remember the Scrivener ads that I did a few weeks ago? Yeah, you'll get that. You'll get that for a week. Now, I don't know, if I'm honest. I don't know if it will make any difference to your sales. I can't really promise anything. I can say that this show is listened to thousands of times a month all around the world. So it might help you. It will definitely help us, if I'm honest. All the pledges help keep bringing you chats with the world's best authors as often as we can. You can send me all the details about your book. I will read them through. I will parlay it up nicely and kind of professionally, and I will give it a massive shout-out, I promise. You can do this for just 1 week for a one-off pledge of $40. $40 a month, and you can get your book to sponsor the show over at patreon.com/writersroutine. Right, let's get back into it then with Anthony McGowan talking about his Carnegie Award shortlisted Lark. Although we're really talking about all of his stories and generally how he works. He's written across such a wide range of books. It's interesting to see how he dips his toe into each genre. In this half, we talk about how much he knows about a story before he starts writing. Also, on that, you can hear about the amazing idea he had for his very first book. It's utterly brilliant. Can't believe I've never heard of the idea before. And you can find out why he had to change that idea to get it published. We also talk about how he forced a plot into a novel that really was solely about place. And we pick things up talking about writing for young adults and kids. How does he adopt the voice to talk to a kid, to talk to a teenager? Adopt it so he's not preachy, but not pandering, not patronising. And how does he make sure that people actually want to read his stories?
I found it straight away very easy to write with that teenage voice. And that's, you know, I know it's a slightly cliched answer, but it's because so many of the men in particular I know my age were still basically teenagers. You know, whenever I get together with my pals, we end up talking about, you know, the girls we fancied when we were in the lower six and that sort of thing. So, you know, in some ways I was always tethered to that world. And I had a particularly vivid and intense time at secondary school. In many ways I had a great time, but my first secondary school was a violent, rather dangerous place. So stuff happened every day that burned itself into my mind and later came out as stories. I was always slightly in that world. I never quite escaped from that school world. But in terms of technique, nearly all of my, in fact, I think all of my teenage books are first person narratives. And that's my basic advice for getting into that any particular world. You've got to have a first person narrator. And that meant that that because I was telling the story through the mouth of a 14, 15, 16 year old kid, I automatically found myself adopting the right sort of age appropriate language for that readership. So it was that combination of me still being in that world and then using a first person narrator. Now, obviously, the danger is I'm a fully grown adult person, so I don't know how teenagers today talk amongst themselves. As soon as you introduce an adult into any teenage group, that they change the way they behave. So I had to kind of assume that there was enough continuity with the way that we used to be 30 years ago, 30 plus years ago when I started, so that there was a connection there. And perhaps even more importantly, in terms of technique, all of my teenage narrators are slightly odd, quirky individuals telling their story. So they're not typical teenagers.
But also, what about the words that you're using, making sure you aren't using language that's too complicated for a kid?
Yeah, with teenagers, I basically didn't dumb down the language at all because of the nature of my kind of slightly geeky narrators. I don't think I would have ever written for younger children if I hadn't actually had children myself. So I remember talking to my son in particular when he was at junior school, and he was talking about how, you know, his interactions with his pals and the gangs they had and the roles within the gangs. And that really was like getting in a time machine. Suddenly I zip back to before my teenage year, which had been so large in my head. And I remembered again being a younger child and the kind of adventures that I had. And so I managed to remember my way back into that world. But without Gabriel's voice to as a kind of bit of grit around which the pearl formed, I don't think I could have done it. But I suppose as well, there's a kind of puerile element to my humour at the best of times. And so I really let that run wild. So my books for younger kids are they're pretty silly and rude.
Can I ask a question?
There's a lot of toilet humour.
Can I ask a question that once again, it might sound quite forthright. I don't mean it to. It's just the way it will come out. You mentioned that your YA books, the ones you write for teenagers, tend to only sell about 10,000 copies, whereas the ones for younger kids will sell a lot more. Why don't you focus more of your attention on writing young books if that's where the money is?
Because there's very complicated formulas at work here for a writer. There's the stuff that I want to do, the stuff that I love doing, but then I also have to pay the bills. It's tough. And also, I suppose that you've got to write the story that's inside you at that moment. You know, when my kids were younger, I had lots of stories that were welling up inside me aimed at younger children. And that, as my kids are, you know, my daughter's 16, my son's 20, I think that actually dried up a little bit. So it was harder then to force myself to write again for younger children. Just the ideas didn't quite come. Most of my most recent books have gone back again to writing for teenagers. I wrote a series of books for a rather brilliant small publisher called Barrington Stoke, who originally concentrated on books for people with, for reluctant readers in general, but people with dyslexia in particular. And so I wrote some slightly, for me, unusual teenage books, which are much more pared down and simple and straightforward, a series of books about two brothers in Yorkshire in very desperate, poor circumstances, and the older brother has learning difficulties, and the younger brother is essentially his carer because the family has collapsed around them. and they were, as I say, much more pared down and focused on my earlier teenage stuff, which was very flamboyant and elaborate and complex. I very much found myself back in that world, which is my own background in a small town in Yorkshire. And I even though they weren't huge sellers, they got quite a lot of prestige. They got very nice reviews. One was shortlisted for the Carnegie Prize. Actually, the second one's just been shortlisted for the Carnegie Prize. And I suppose, in a way, that prestige took the place of commerce in being that energy that drove me into writing them. So I think that they're probably both my best books and my most highly acclaimed. Most of my books are character-driven, and these certainly are. But also, for the first time in Brock, it's a book about a place. So I was brought up in this small town, stroke big village in West Yorkshire called Sherburn in Elmet. It's an unusual, weird, quirky place. It's an ancient settlement. It's got an agricultural aspect, but also a kind of industrial aspect. And that bit of West Yorkshire, it's a kind of scrubby landscape where pit villages are interspersed with fields and light industrial estates. It's a strange kind of world. And I wanted to write about a poor family in desperate circumstances in that world. And also, I suppose I almost cynically thought about, with the main character, how do I make the reader love that main character? And I'm sure you've had interviewers have mentioned this before. This is a very cynical technique called Pat the Dog, which is used in a lot of film writing, where you show your main character being kind to a weaker character or an animal. And so my main character, Nicky, is the carer for his disabled elder brother. So that's already you're on that character's side. But then also the other cynical technique for making your characters lovable is to give them undeserved suffering. And so Nicky's family situation is desperate. Classically, the way you make your child in particular hero, that the focus of the reader's affections, is to make them an orphan. And although Nicky's not literally an orphan, he's kind of an orphan. His mother's left home and his father has completely fallen apart. So he's essentially on his own with his brother in the family. So there was a slightly cynical engineering of forcing the reader's affections onto the side of Nicky, and then putting him in this particularly, I hope, well-realised, gritty northern setting. And then I also knew that I wanted to make the series partly a kind of blending of the urban world and also the natural world. So there's a kind of animal spirit that haunts each of the stories. And in the very first one, it's a badger. So the very first story in the series is called Brock. And the two brothers come across some rather bad lads who are out badger baiting, you know, when you take dogs to hunt and kill badgers. And they manage to save a baby badger from the people killing them. And they take the badger home, baby badger home. They nurture it. And their dad kind of helps them a little bit with this. And it helps him get out of his own particular trough. And by looking after the badger, they begin the healing process of the family. And that continues over the next four books.
Everything that you've described to me so far has all been an ideal for the story. It's all been quite character-led. But you need a plot in there, don't you? So how does that come about? For instance, when you've got the idea of these boys and they don't come from... they come from quite impoverished backgrounds. Then how are you thinking an idea that is going to thread you through a few hundred pages of this?
No, it's a very good question. And most of my other books, plot's very important to me. You know, as a reader, I love a well-engineered plot. And so even my kind of slightly chaotic, funny, rude teenage books and my books for younger children, if you strip that away, underneath it, that the plot mechanics are very, hopefully, they're very cleverly worked out. With this quartet, it was slightly different. They are so character-driven and so embedded in that world that the plotting is... I'm not saying it's unimportant, but it was secondary. I suppose for the first time, what I wanted to be in these stories wasn't funny or clever or rude or attention-grabbing. I wanted them to be true or to feel true. And sometimes a mechanical plot can rip you away from that sense that this is a real world and real people. But within that, I suppose each of the stories has an adventure kind of element to it. So that in the first one, they have to look after the badger and suppose defend it from the original badger baiters. So there's a kind of tense, thrillerish plot somewhere in there. In the second in the series, Pike, the two boys, they come across a body floating in a small lake, and the body has around its wrist a rather beautiful watch, which they realize that if they can get hold of this watch, it's a Rolex Submariner worth 20,000 quid. It will transform their family finances. So it's a kind of little adventure story in how they manage to or ultimately fail to get hold their hands on this watch. So there is a kind of plot device in there. The third one is about Nicky's standing up to a bully at school and falling in love for the first time. I suppose the fourth one has the simplest and the most plot-led kind of structure. Lark, that their family has almost been healed, so things are much, much better at home. But the two boys go on a walk on the North Yorkshire moors and get lost in a blizzard. Fall down a ravine and it doesn't end very well for all of them.
Well, let me whittle it down to the simplest part of that. So, you know, you want to tell a story about these two boys, as I say, that come from poverty. Very simply, this might be quite a strange question to articulate for an author, but what do you do next? What happens next in terms of thinking it through, getting ideas, plotting it down before you actually start writing?
Well, I suppose, again, as I said right at the start of our talk, I tend to get this sudden kind of flash of what will be the kind of, in embryonic form, the whole story. It tends to be a situation or an idea rather than the whole plot, but within that idea, that the kind of plot is in embryonic form. So, with Lark, the plot is very, very simple. The two boys go on a walk and it goes horribly wrong. They get stuck in a blizzard. It's a kind of survivalist story. So it didn't really require much complex plotting work, if you like. And once I knew that was roughly what was going to happen, I sat down and I started to type. But I think that with all of my stories, even when you have an idea for a plot, you know that you're doing something right if the characters perhaps don't want to exactly follow that plot. They have their own ideas and they might wrench you either side of your plot line. But, I've never really struggled with working out what to do next once I've had that original idea. It's simply a matter, my job as a writer is to sit down and work it through to the end. And it's, the difficult part is just those, that mechanics of getting myself physically, getting my fingers moving. Once I'm there, it's just not trudging along, but you follow that path. What I'll know is roughly the start point and roughly the end point. Going back to my very first book, Hellbent, so it begins with a teenage boy dying. And it's a kind of, there's a comedy aspect, which is that hell's kind of moved on and he's punished in a way appropriate to teenage boy, which, to cut a long story short, he's subjected to an infinite period of boredom. But he
this
works
teenage
out.
Teenage boy, very quickly, he must have done some pretty brutal things in the first like 15 years of his life to end up in hell.
Yeah, part of the plot is about he's going to find out exactly what he's done to deserve being there. So that is revealed along the way. But then, because he's the little kind of plot device was that, given that hell is specially tailored to each individual person there, he works out that there might be a bit of hell that would be actually quite pleasant for a teenage boy. If you've got an elderly classical music fan who loves classical literature, perhaps if that teenage boy can find his bit of hell and be punished there, it won't be so bad. So it's the kind of journey aspect. So I had both those ideas in my head. I also had this idea that at the end there must be a chance that he could possibly escape from hell. So those were the kind of plot points along the way, and everything else was me enjoying myself. It wasn't like driving along the motorway. It was more like knowing that I had to get from London to Yorkshire and taking the and broadly heading north all the time, but letting whim pull me either side of that main path. And I suppose nearly all my books have got that same kind of a form, that I'll know roughly where I need to end up, but I want to enjoy the journey, let it meander. Occasionally you'll find yourself in a dead end, and that bit won't quite have worked. But I think that a big part of my, especially my earlier books, was the slightly flamboyant Baroque or Rococo style they're told in. There's a lot of complex jokes and elaborate metaphors and linguistic play along the way. So that was the other important component of me, both getting that story told, but making that the journey itself exciting, and not exactly the wrong word, but visually and orally interesting.
Last question. As someone that has, as you say, written 50 or so books, and a very, very simple one to end, what have you learned about how you tell stories and how you write that particularly works for you over the course of, 20 years of writing books?
Well, that's such a hard question. I think that I've had arguments with a lot of my writer friends about this. So I think there are two paradigms for writing that I've come across. And most of my writer friends have the first paradigm, which is that the creative process is like, it's an internal one. That this thing of beauty is inside you, and your job as an author is to get it out, like laying an egg, like this kind of beautiful Fabergé egg. So your relationship is with your internal processes. But the other paradigm is the one I've always preferred, which is that writing is a kind of conversation. So I'm in conversation with my reader. So rather than focusing in all the time, I'm looking out at the reader and thinking, is this making you laugh yet? Are you interested? Are you bored? So I'm always trying to perhaps seize the reader by the lapels and shake him or her and make them entertained. So what works for me is that conversational paradigm of writing, thinking about even a basic question like, why would somebody else want to read this? And as a reader, why do you read as a reader? Because the plot grips you, because you love the characters, because it's funny, because it's frightening. And so those are all outwardly focused aesthetic goals in a way. So that's what works for me. It's looking out rather than looking in, I wouldn't even say that's the way that every other writer should write. But I would say it's something to think about. By all means, regard yourself as an artist creating this thing of beauty inside you. But occasionally, look up, see, are those eyes of the reader, are they beginning to film over with boredom?
And that is it for this week's Writer's Routine. Thank you so much to Anthony McGowan for sparing the time out of his, as you can hear, horrendously busy work days when he wasn't at the British Library to come and have a chat with me on the show. You can find out more about his Carnegie Award shortlisted Lark over at writersroutine.com. If you heard anything in that chat that you think will help the way that you tell stories, if you would like to say thanks to the show, pay a little back, you can by pledging whatever you can over at patreon.com/writersroutine. Also, I'd love it if you could leave a review for the show over on Apple Podcasts. Make sure you give us a follow on Twitter as well. We are at Writers Pod on there. Next week, we are chatting to the best-selling Rachel Abbott. She sold over 4 million psychological thrillers. 4 million! Her new one is called The Murder Game, and she'll be on the show next week to tell us all about how she wrote it on Writer's Routine. I will see you then. Bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.